In first place, thank you very much for the center to allow me to come here and to read my paper and to share with you what I thought about Bhattacharya. I prepared a rather maybe long paper. I hope I can read it out and that we can discuss it later. The title is, as you said, Rethinking Advaita Within the Colonial Predicament, the Subject as Freedom and the Confrontative Philosophy of K.C. Bhattacharya. My aim in this presentation and in this talk is to examine the distinctive way in which the prominent Bengali philosopher Krishnachandra Bhattacharya engaged with Advaita Vedanta during the terminal phase of the colonial period. I propose to do this by looking first at ways in which Krishnachandra understood the role of his own philosophizing within the colonial predicament. I will call this his agenda in confrontative philosophy. I shall proceed then by sketching out the manner in which this agenda was successfully carried out through his engagement with the Advaitic knowledge of self, with the Advaitic notion of self-knowledge as articulated in his Subject as Freedom from 1930. I shall begin then addressing Krishnachandra's self-understanding as an Indian philosopher and contend that his philosophy is intentionally 1. Comparative, 2. Reactive, 3. Professing a distinctive theory and method toward the intellectual Sanskrit past of South Asia, 4. Confrontative, and 5. Expectant. So I start 1. Though he himself never used the term, by calling his philosophy comparative, I mean to say that Krishnachandra conceived his philosophizing as an intellectual endeavor that cuts across cultural and historical boundaries. That is, K.C. Bhattacharya practiced as endorsed a sort of philosophy that engaged with and was informed by elements and insights from more than one cultural ground and historical period. To be sure, he was not the only Anglophone Indian philosopher committed to such practice. Quite the contrary. As Jonardhan Ganeri has insightfully suggested, comparative philosophy is, and I quote, an expedient heuristic introduced at a particular moment in world history as a part of a global movement toward intellectual decolonization, end of quote. According to this idea, comparative philosophy is a cultural phenomenon that emerged during the 19th century precisely within the sort of political and cultural milieu in which Krishnachandra and all other Anglophone Indian philosophers lived and wrote, a colonial predicament. Far from being an exception then, Bhattacharya practiced comparative philosophy together with many other Indian intellectuals writing in English during the terminal phase of the British rule of India. We should remember, however, that the cultural boundaries and landscape that these intellectuals were committed to crossing and comparing philosophically are not neutral, homogeneous, and well-defined entities. They are, rather, conventional constructs and often heterogeneous fields that are, to a large extent, fluid. In the case of K.C. Bhattacharya, I think it is hard to deny that his conception of Indian and Western culture, and even more so of their relation, was primarily shaped by a colonial imagination and narrative on East and West. Consequently, I submit that Krishnachandra's pioneer pursuit of comparative philosophy was deeply embedded in the colonial narrative on Indian and Western cultures alike. One early example from his work must suffice to illustrate what I mean. In his studies in Vedantism from 1907, Bhattacharya described his engagement with Vedanta in a highly programmatic manner, stating that while he was not interested in exploring the specificities of Vedanta in relation to other systems of Indian philosophy, he puts special care to reproduce Vedanta in such a manner as constituting what is distinctively Indian, and therefore in stark contrast with European habits of thought. As I read him, Bhattacharya was simply and uncritically taking for granted that, and I quote him, there are sundry deep-seated differences between Eastern and Western speculation, end of quote. The shortcomings of this view are not hard to identify. Bhattacharya was under the lure of essentialism that disposed him to read the relation between Indian and Western philosophical cultures through a sort of hermeneutics of radical difference while reading each of the relata, that is, Western philosophy and Indian philosophy through a sort of hermeneutics of radical sameness. I would even venture to say that his hermeneutics of radical difference could be performed precisely to the extent his hermeneutics of radical sameness was. In this scenario, Krishnachandra endorsed one sort of cross-cultural exploration. And though he did not explicitly exclude others, he remained silent about them. What I mean to say is that Bhattacharya conceived an intellectual enterprise that aimed to locate itself within classical Indian thought and move therefrom toward modern Western philosophy. The dynamism of his endeavor was oriented, in first place, to the intellectual past of South Asia and then launched, in second place, toward modern Western philosophy. Hence, Bhattacharya was explicit that his concern was about, quote, bringing out the relations, end of quote, that Vedanta had with respect to modern Western philosophy. Before moving on to the second constitutive factor of his philosophy, I wish to flag one question. If this was the specific dynamism and orientation of Bhattacharya comparativism, then what potentially interesting directions for cross-cultural comparative philosophic undertaking were ruled out here from the start? Two. The reactive feature of Bhattacharya's philosophic project should not go unnoticed. As well attested in his Swarajin Ideas from 1928, Bhattacharya was condemning and reacting against the cultural and political asymmetric relation enacted by the British colonialism and was willing to revert them. He thematized those relations in terms of cultural subjugation and defined it as a slavery that happened when, and I quote him, one's own traditional caste of ideas and sentiments is superseded without comparison or competition by a new caste representing an alien culture and possesses one like a ghost. This subjection is a slavery of the spirit. End of quote. Some of the terms through which Krishnachandra addressed the dysfunctional nature of colonial relations, among these terms we have impact, hybridization, patchwork, imposed ideal, response, mechanical adjustment, conflict of ideas and ideals, confusion, and so on, betray his overall aversion to the cultural reality that constituted his life world. More telling still was his repulse toward the evil impact that this process of cultural subjugation had on the minds of modern Indian subjects, condemning them as habits of soulless thinking, mechanical thinking of the galvanic mind, and shadow mind, and I quote, that functions like a real mind except in the matter of genuine creativeness, end of quote. Bhattacharya narrated then a powerful etiology of these modern Indian habits of soulless thinking, pointing to the language policy in colonial India, the imposition of the British educative system, and the impact of Western political, social, and economic institutions on the life force of modern Indians as immediately responsible for this deplorable state of affairs. To be sure, however, Krishnachandra reacted as much against the cultural dominance of the West over India as against the acritical attitude and passivity with which modern Indians were ready to put aside their native identities while adopting modern Western cultural standards instead. In response to the acritical amalgamation that give rise to the dysfunctional cultural patchwork and hybridization, Bhattacharya made a plea for an open-eyed, vital and critical assimilation of East and West, and stressed the need for modern Indians to creatively examine and critically examine their own cultural heritage as well as the ideas and values coming from the West. Thus, Bhattacharya lamented the lack of a, quote, vigorous output of an Indian contribution in a distinctively Indian style to the culture and thoughts and thought of the modern world, contribution specially in the humanist subject like history, philosophy, or literature, end of quote, and he embarked on a philosophical project in order to remedy the lack of such an output. In other words, all this meant that in countering Eurocentrism and the political hegemony of the British Empire, Bhattacharya's project in comparative philosophy was targeting a very particular audience. Its recipient was, typically, a modern Indian subject who, knowing herself to be underrated and subjugated in her predicament as colonized, and awaking from her acritical cultural assimilation of the West, was ready to strive for inverting the colonial asymmetry and restoring her agency by exercising her political and epistemic sovereignty. Simply put, the recipient of Krishnachandra's comparative philosophy was an epistemologically empowered modern Indian subject, thinking and acting for intellectual decolonization. The comparative philosophy he had in mind was therefore a project in Indian comparative philosophy, meant for the immediate benefits of modern Indian subjects. 3. As for the theory and method for engaging with the classical past of South Asia, perhaps the most relevant is to stress from the outset that in his outlook, Bhattacharya was responding both to historicism and Orientalism in their scholarly pursuit of objectifying classical Indian culture. As it has been discussed in the literature on Orientalism, the objectification of Indian culture by the West, which was advertised as a scientific and unbiased pursuit of knowledge, was instead, at least in part, a powerful tool for mastering and subduing the colonial order via providing a scientific objective rationale for doing so. K.C. Bhattacharya was undoubtedly sensitive to the intricate relation between Western scientific pursuit of knowledge about classical Indian culture and its implicit quest for power and its cultural hegemony. It's Eurocentrism, yeah? I think it is fair to submit that Krishnachandra was reacting against such a practice of objectification when he professed his alternative. Instead of aiming at objectifying Indian culture for the benefit of the colonizer, the retrieval of classical Indian philosophy became for him, the colonized, a sui generis modality of intellectual decolonization and emancipation, an act of epistemic empowerment. This meant a sort of outlook in which rediscovering the intellectual past of South Asia had a meaningful and far-reaching cultural function to fulfill in the present. It was to be engaged by modern Indian intellectuals in order to confront the order and discourse of the colonial present. I'm alluding here to what Jonardo Ganeri has recently discussed in terms of the, quote, discovery of the Indian classicity as a technique of intellectual decolonization, end of quote. Throughout this discovery, modern Indian intellectuals attempted to retrieve their Sanskrit cultural past with the purpose to provincializing or decentralizing Europe. In such an outlook, reading and appealing to any Sanskrit Shastra or engaging with any classical Indian philosophy for that matter had indeed nothing to do, as Bhattacharya explicitly claimed, with armchair philosophy, nor with the attitude of a main narrator of a historian of philosophy. It was neither, quote, to be regarded as the special property of the academic philosophy mongers to be hacked up by them in technical views, end of quote, nor as an exclusively theoretic affair, with Bhattacharya condemned as a soulless joining of hypotheses. It was rather charged with the subversive energy of a sympathetic interpreter who professed aesthetic sympathy towards Indian ancient life ideal, and so, in classical Indian philosophy, particularly Advaita Vedanta, a form of life that deeply questioned the hegemony of the Western discourse, lifestyle, and political dominance. This heavily loaded outlook also informed his methodology. Already in 1907, Krishnachandra made an important distinction between history of philosophy and philosophy as such in terms of their aims and method. Bhattacharya resisted reducing philosophic engagement to the one concerned with historicity of philosophic thinking. Though he did not regard these two disciplines to be mutually exclusive but supplementary, he argued in favor of the logical priority of the former over the later. By doing so, Krishnachandra was above all endorsing a sort of autonomy of philosophic thinking from history, downplaying in this way the dimension of historicity within philosophic understanding itself. He backed up his stance by reflecting on the pitfalls associated with these two disciplines. Pondering over the perils of anachronism versus those of forensic studies respectively, Bhattacharya was happy to stress that explaining away any philosophic problem by dissolving it into any number and whatsoever sort of non-philosophic causes entail a serious epistemic violence. Not only that, his concern in resisting such disciplinary reductionism contained a cultural and political dimension. For what Bhattacharya was reacting against was, in the final analysis, the practice through which Western philologically informed historicism engaged with Indian philosophy and aimed at reducting and explaining away its genuine philosophic contents, however they might differ from their Western counterpart. His target figure here was George Thibaut. Moving away from such a kind of reductive undertaking, he excused himself for adopting the voice of a sympathetic interpreter of an Indian student of Vedanta, whose agenda was to engage with classical Indian philosophy with the intention to interpreting it in relation to the philosophical problems as discussed in modern Western philosophy. 4. I would like to delve further now in the specific intellectual activity that Krishnachandra had in mind. For addressing his philosophy as comparative or cross-cultural may give the wrong impression that his intercultural undertaking was shaped on the analogy with an open and ecumenical dialogue. I contend that by doing so, we fail to appreciate the very specific terms that appear in his descriptions of the comparative endeavor he had in mind, and by doing so miss the intention of his comparativism. Those terms are confrontation and contrast, and they occur respectively in Swarajan ideas and in studies in Vedantism. In those occasions, Bhattacharya was explicitly pronouncing himself on the kind of comparativism he professed. In the first case, he spoke normatively about the future he foresaw for Indian philosophy. It was, indeed, a thoroughly comparative philosophy with well-defined terms of comparison. The verb expressing the activity to be done was to confront. While the possible outcomes of such undertaking were sorted out in terms of synthesis or and a reasoned rejection of either philosophy. To be sure, Bhattacharya reflected on the possible attitude toward the encounter of East and West at other occasions, and theoretically at least, he left no place for doubt that he was open to acknowledge that critical confrontation of both philosophic culture might well result in a rejection of Eastern alternatives. At the same time, Krishnachandra plainly and simply believed that that the differences between Eastern and Western philosophic traditions were deeply seated and unsurmountable, though he did not necessarily imply that they could not coexist side by side. Thus, concerned as Bhattacharya was with defining and highlighting those outlooks that he identified as distinctively Indian, and wishing to make an, quote, Indian contribution in a distinctive Indian style to the culture and thought of the modern world, end of quote, Bhattacharya's philosophy was confrontative in that it aimed to a. face modern Western and classical Indian philosophy with each other, b. clarify their fundamental notions, and c. give an assessment of modern Western standards from the standpoint of classical Indian philosophy. The confrontative feature of this comparativism lies, then, in the fact that he took sides with classical Indian philosophy, took it as his own culture, while he alienated modern Western philosophy and then prioritized only one of the theoretically sketched outcomes that their comparison might have entailed. This is well illustrated in the fact that, though there are plenty of philosophically interesting insights in Krishnachandra's discussion concerning how certain philosophic problems were shaped and discussed in modern Western philosophy, and concerning how they may be either resolved or entirely dismissed from the standpoint of classical Indian philosophy, to my knowledge, there is non-explicit exploration in the other direction. To be sure, in the course of Bhattacharya's confrontative engagement, we never come across explicit statement of how certain problems to be found in classical Indian philosophy might be solved or just dismissed through modern Western philosophic insights. I suggest, therefore, that K.C. Bhattacharya's comparative philosophy was confrontative in that it professed a one-sided, confronting attitude toward modern Western philosophy, particularly Kantian transcendentalism. 5. The last building block of Bhattacharya's confrontative philosophy that I will address concerns its very expectations. This is best illustrated in the 9th paragraph of Swaraj in Ideas. Toward the end of that highly informative paragraph, Krishnachandra outlined in an unmistakable terms the therapeutic potentials that his comparative agenda entailed by linking its concern with the issue of Indian cultural identity. Bhattacharya foreshadowed that Indian comparative philosophy had the potential to aid modern Indians in their acute need to redefine their own cultural identity in the new emergent frames of a plural and cosmopolitan modern world. That is to say, in Bhattacharya's conception of it, Indian comparative philosophy was one indispensable chapter of a broader autobiographic narrative of modern Indians. He foresaw that Indian comparative philosophy could be successfully deployed by the then still colonial Indian intellectuals as a powerful and methodic means by which to rediscover their own cultural identity and restoring, and I quote, the continuity of his old self with his present-day self, end of quote, and contrasting it with the Western other. In other words, Bhattacharya believed that healing the fracture in Indian cultural identity, past and present, was an all-important imperative for the modern Indian mind, and that comparative philosophy, Indian comparative philosophy, was a methodic means to achieve this. I will move now to illustrate briefly how this project in confrontative philosophy was enacted in Bhattacharya's philosophy of self-knowledge as exposed in his The Subject as Freedom from 1930. The explicit and immediate intention that Krishnachandra had in writing his masterpiece was to inaugurate a new and special branch of philosophy that he called spiritual or transcendental psychology. In order to define its specificity, he contrasted its concern, method, and prospect with those of metaphysics, empirical psychology, epistemology, and Kantian transcendental philosophy. In stark contrast with Kantian skepticism toward the very possibility of self-knowledge and his denial of a concrete method through which the self could be known, Krishnachandra's foremost concern in The Subject as Freedom was to justify critically the possibility of self-knowledge. In addition, he aimed to provide a theoretical map that could be deployed, during a gradual cognitive introspection culminating in the disclosure of the self as freedom from objectivity in a modality of knowing without thinking. On the whole, Bhattacharya's vindication of transcendental psychology as a new and special branch of philosophy entailed confronting Kantian transcendentalism on four major points of contention. A. The crucial issue of self-knowledge. B. The relation between thinking and knowing. C. The attitude deployed in thinking the possibility of self-knowledge. And D. The method for knowing the self. Bhattacharya believed that Kantian transcendental idealism was unsound in denying that the self could be known and that there was no cognitive method available through which it could be apprehended. As he understood him, Kant's denial of self-knowledge relied heavily upon his conception of knowledge as resulting from the synthesis between the a priori categories of understanding and intuition. Thus, though the self could become the object of thinking, it could not be known to the extent it was not available to intuition. Bhattacharya contended that the core of Kantian skepticism lie in the inadequate objective attitude in which he reflected on the possibility of self-knowledge. The same objective attitude toward the self was also displayed in metaphysics and empirical psychology. which explained for him their failure to apprehend the self. For Bhattacharya, the objective attitude they exhibited was the very reason accounting for their shortcoming. By objective attitude he meant the assumption that the object disclosed in any epistemic act is an entity whose being is entirely independent from its epistemic apprehension. Hence, it implied a commitment to realism, in that it believed in the existence of the object as independently of knowing it, as independent of knowing it. Furthermore, he reasoned that the minimal sense in which the objective attitude was displayed was in addressing the object of knowledge as what is meant in speech. When it came to the core issue of self-knowledge, Bhattacharya thought that the Kantian approach, as well as the approach displayed in metaphysics and empirical psychology, was inadequate in that they conceived the self as if it was an independent entity, an object out there, to be apprehended by a certain epistemic faculty and addressed as what is meant. For Bhattacharya, such engagement with the subject was deemed to failure from the start, for he professed that to be objectified and meant in speech was the very definition of the object per se. As he wrote in the first paragraph of The Subject as Freedom, quote, "Object is what is meant, including the object of sense perception and all contents that have necessary reference to it," end of quote. With such a radical and broad definition of the object, and to the extent he took the subject and the object to be diametrically opposed to each other, Bhattacharya believed that the subject as such could not be apprehended in the objective attitude and addressed as what is meant in speech, for attempting to know it in this manner implied objectifying it and seeking to know the subject as what by definition it is not, the object. In this way, Bhattacharya contended that the subject could not be known through the objective attitude displayed in metaphysics and empirical psychology. However, acknowledging this failure did not imply, against Kant, professing skepticism toward the possibility of self-knowledge. Bhattacharya believed, instead, that theorizing the possibility of self-knowledge requires admitting that it is possible to be aware of the subject in a way that does not entail awareness of it as what is meant. Transcendental psychology, as a special branch of philosophy concerned with self-knowledge, was founded on such an admission and the endorsement of the subjective attitude toward the self. This crucial claim required, however, clarifying the status of self-knowledge in transcendental psychology. In other words, Bhattacharya has to precise in what way the subject was disclosed and available to philosophic thinking. In seeking to provide a reasonable answer to this question, he argued that A. Philosophy must start from what can be spoken, in his terminology, from the speakable. B. That the subject is actually available through language as what is intended by the first person pronoun I. And C. That this sort of acquaintance with the subject is not the same as its disclosure as what is meant. Consequently, he maintained that what can be spoken, communicated, and understood in language is more than what can be meant by it. Advocating that the self is actually presented in the awareness of it as I, and that, as a philosophy of self-knowledge, transcendental psychology builds on this sort of acquaintance in first place, allowed Bhattacharya to pin down the idea that the self is only partially available to philosophic thinking. To the extent it is speakable in language, through the first person pronoun I, the subject is understood as a believed content, but it is not apprehended as what is meant. To be sure, Krishnachandra contended that in transcendental psychology, the understanding and exposition of the self finds itself in an intermediate stage, midway between its full apprehension in a mystic intuition, his words, and its misapprehension as what is meant in metaphysics and empirical psychology. In this scheme of things, Bhattacharya intended transcendental psychology to be a theoretic description of the different modalities of relation between the subject and the object, interpreted as functions of the subject in relation to the object. This theoretical outline was, in turn, to be deployed as a symbolic map and used during a spiritual discipline of cognitive inwardizing, that his terms, which, strictly speaking, dwells beyond the limits of transcendental psychology. This meant acknowledging that as a philosophy, transcendental psychology was propedeutic to self-knowledge, not its full fulfillment. As to the subjective attitude vindicated in transcendental psychology, Bhattacharya explained that it entailed a reversion of the inadequate objective attitude in that it believed in the total disentanglement of the subject from the object, and in that it interpreted their relation as a subjective function rather than as a property of the object. Thus, while in the objective attitude the object was taken for granted in a realist fashion and the function of the subject-object relation interpreted as depending upon it, upon the object, in the subjective attitude it was interpreted as an entirely subjective function in which subjectivity negates and alienates itself. In this way, the awareness-independent status of the object was jeopardized and subsumed under the range of the subjective functions. In this framework, Krishnachandra presented transcendental psychology as a new and special study occupied with interpreting the fact of the subjective functions in relation to the subject as such. It was concerned with the systematic outline of the modalities of objectification or entanglement in which the subject get associated or identified with the object of consciousness and thereby disclosed as what it is not. As he wrote, quote, "The facthood of the knowing function and the subjective function in general is believed, though not known, and is elaborated into a system of symbolism in a new philosophic study which may be called spiritual or transcendental psychology." End of quote. Furthermore, though outlining those modalities of association was entirely a theoretical task, Bhattacharya believed that thematizing them philosophically allowed for interpreting them in opposite terms as modalities of dissociation. This in turn opened the possibility for enacting them in a spiritual discipline of cognitive inwardizing, which is a sort of cognitive distancing, in which the subject was to be gradually dissociated from objectivity and in a long run known in a non-discursive manner as completely free from it. Bhattacharya devoted more than half of his subject as freedom to a detailed, highly syncretic and difficult to crack description of these levels or grades of subjective freedom from the object. Those broad grades of subjectivity are bodily subjectivity, psychic subjectivity, and spiritual subjectivity. That is, the subject as entangled and confused with the body, the psychic fact, and the spiritual. Furthermore, each of these broad grades of subjectivity was subdivided in three, constituting in this way an itinerary of 9 stages through which the subject was to be gradually disentangled from objectivity and realized as negative freedom, the fulfillment of self-knowledge. I will bring my home point now home by stressing the confrontative feature of this plot and the deployment of Advaita that Bhattacharya made in the subject as freedom in order to make his case. First, Bhattacharya presented his idea of transcendental psychology as a philosophy of self-knowledge in sheer contrast to Kantian skepticism on the same and the shortcomings of Western metaphysics and empirical psychology in this respect. Transcendent type psychology was to succeed precisely where those Western disciplines failed. In other words, Bhattacharya carefully selected the topic of self-knowledge as the tertium comparationis of his comparative exercise and made of it the main point of contrast between classical Indian and modern Western philosophy. I think it is fair to say that, as a modern Indian philosopher writing in English during the colonial period, Krishnachandra appropriated the classical Sanskrit Advaita, which he regarded as the cult of self-knowledge par excellence, and used it skillfully as a resource to confronting the Western order and its putative, inadequate, objective attitude towards self-knowledge. Second, I have stressed that Krishnachandra aimed to outline a method for attaining a full-blown cognitive realization of the self as freedom from objectivity. He believed that such a method was explicitly denied by Kantian transcendental idealism and was entirely unavailable in modern Western philosophy. It was, however, available and known in classical Indian Advaita as sadhana. Hence, I contend that Bhattacharya took it as constituting what is distinctively Indian and confronted modern Western philosophy from this Indian vantage point. In addition to that, he redefined the very concept of philosophy from the standpoint of Indian Advaita. That is, he redefined philosophy on the analogy with the Vedantic Manana as propedeutic to self-knowledge, and talk often about a method of cognitive inwardizing, which I surmise, was his translation of the Vedantic Nididhyasana. Hence, I suggest that in order to appreciate the full import of Bhattacharya confrontative philosophy, we should acknowledge that it was not only the case that he conceptualized Advaita through and in the light of Western categories of understanding, but that he redefined some of those fundamental categories, for example, the concept of philosophy, from the standpoint of Indian Advaita. Third, since Bhattacharya believed that the knowledge of the self was not fully achieved in the domain of philosophy, but was realized through a spiritual introspection that was not discursive, he was explicitly challenging the epistemology of conflating knowing with thinking. As I have stressed, Bhattacharya defended the idea that philosophic thinking was propedeutic to self-knowledge in that it provided a detailed theoretical description of the stages through which the subject could be realized as freedom from objectivity during a spiritual, introspective, and non-discursive discipline. Bhattacharya believed, however, that Kant submitted to such a troublesome conflating of knowing with thinking, and that defending the idea of self-knowledge, the very speciality of the classical Advaita, required avoiding the commitment to such a reductive epistemology. Lastly, we should pay attention to the fact that the project of self-knowledge, as outlined in the subject as freedom, was also a project having to do with liberation. Here, classical Advaita's commitment to moksha to atmajnana, that is, liberation through self-knowledge, was masterfully interpreted by Bhattacharya as the dissociation of the subject from the object. In the technical terms of the subject as freedom, it was a project in negative freedom. To the extent that Krishnachandra believed that modern Western philosophy lacked a concrete method through which the self could be known, and to the extent that classical Indian philosophy, which he epitomized with Advaita Vedanta, was defined by upholding precisely such a method, he was also arguing that classical Indian philosophy is fundamentally different from Western, in that Indian philosophy is concerned with moksha, or liberation, whereas Western philosophy is not. I think that this portrayal of Western and Indian philosophy does not stand the test of contemporary scholarship on either. I have argued in this talk that Bhattacharya's original philosophy of self-knowledge, as exposed in the subject as freedom, is a close enactment of his broader project in confrontative philosophy. As a whole, Bhattacharya's philosophy may be portrayed as a two-tiered narrative on one unique theme. Krishnachandra seemed to be articulating a voice of resistance against objectification, one on the level of the abstract or transcendental subjectivity, and another on the level of the flesh and blood Indian colonized subjectivity. As I have stressed, the rationale for this confrontative philosophic program was deeply embedded in the colonial predicament and its evil political and cultural asymmetries. From my analysis, and assuming that to compare is to compare A with B from a standpoint C in respect to D, I'm willing to conclude that K.C. Bhattacharya's confrontative philosophy was a brilliant performance in intellectual decolonization via an interpretative, imaginative, and systematic engagement with classical Advaita aimed at confronting what Bhattacharya took to be the status quo of modern Western philosophy with regard to self-knowledge. From this vantage point, I think it is right to conclude that Bhattacharya's comparative philosophy was thoughtfully subversive. Thank you very much.